Happy Tuesday, everybody. It's another day here with Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect, and we've got a very exciting show, and I hope you will stay with us, because it's not just about genealogy. It's about spirit, and it's about the spirit that is affected by, that we're all affected by, actually, when we turn up secrets in our families. And it's a very touching time, and it's a touching moment. In fact, as a professional genealogist, I've been working with a client this past week, and his story happened to be one of the more compelling that I've ever dealt with. And, you know, it taught me one thing, I think, is that, you know, we don't own these secrets. These secrets own us. And even as a professional genealogist far removed from the situation, I can honestly tell you that the story that we began to uncover, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 days ago, really affected me as well. So one can only imagine the effect that finding family secrets, and we used to call them skeletons, and our guest today, I think we're going to start calling him Ghost, is Steve Luxenburg. And Steve is has spent 25 years as a reporter, an investigative reporter with the Washington Post. And he, in his role as the associate editor, his main job is to focus on special projects, which include in-depth stories on causes and consequences of the financial crisis that unfolded in the fall of 2008. But in the process of all of this, he has used his investigative skills to uncover a story that has turned out to be a very, very compelling book entitled Annie's Ghost and a Journey into a Family Secret. Steve, welcome.
Thanks, Susan.
Really a pleasure to have you. And then really more so, I think, after this last week that I've spent working with someone who, you know, really is not a genealogist. And I think that we talked about that earlier, that genealogy is not just for genealogists. It really is for people to understand more about themselves, where they came from, and as part of the spiritual journey. And unfortunately, when we begin these journeys, we begin to find things that we weren't aware of. And I know that there isn't one of us out there that probably doesn't have a family secret or a story, you know, that we couldn't share. And I think, and we'll talk about this a little later, Steve, that probably by putting this story out, it probably has relieved you of a lot of emotion and things by really making it no longer a secret.
You know, I really can understand your feelings after working with that client, because I've received a lot of email from people who have read the book and they want to share their family secrets with me. In fact, I wrote in the book that I called myself the collector of other families' secrets, because so many people, once they heard my secret, wanted to share theirs. And I ended up making a list, you know, hidden marriages, hidden families, hidden crimes, hidden divorces, even hidden births. And I wouldn't say everybody has a family secret, but I think that every family has a story. And often that story starts somewhere in the past with something that somebody was ashamed of or didn't want to reveal, and which can't, as you put before so well, can't be kept hidden. Secrets, as I write in the second sentence of my book, have a way of working free of their keepers.
There you go. It's very true. And you know, again, I, you know, in thinking about, you know, today's show, after really spending the last 5 days immersed in a family secret, you know, we can't allow these secrets to own us, and they do, until we release them. So you're an investigative reporter, and how in the world did you end up getting involved in doing this story, and really into this, you know, genealogy quest that apparently you got on?
Well, genealogy became a route to telling the story, and as we talked about before the show started, I don't consider myself to be a genealogist. I wouldn't hold myself out as a professional, but I have some professional skills as a result of my investigative reporting, and I took advantage of those to find people who could help me, other people who were genealogists, using resources like Jewish Gen and Ancestry.com and other services, and calling people up who are professional genealogists and saying, here's what I'm trying to find out. But, of course, it would be helpful to have a little bit of a knowledge about the secret we've been referring to, which I'll be glad to reveal because I do so in the very first part of my book. My book is called Annie's Ghosts, A Journey into a Family Secret. It's available in bookstores and online and at public libraries, which have many copies because book clubs are now reading it. What happened was is that in 1995, when I was acting more as a son than a journalist, my mom was quite sick, and she was suffering from emphysema and the consequences of that. She also had a lot of anxiety, and the hospital just assigned a psychiatrist to talk to her about her anxiety, trying to figure out whether there was some medication that might be helpful. And in taking a routine family history, she revealed to him, not to us, we only heard about this after the fact and not directly from her, she revealed to him that she had a disabled sister who was institutionalized, she said, when she was merely 4 years old and her sister was two, and, quote, I don't know what happened to her, end quote. The psychiatrist didn't know this was a secret. She had revealed it casually as part of the routine family history. It wasn't a therapy session, so the social worker who was involved read the notes on this, called up my sister, which is where the book kind of begins, and says, did your mother have a sister? Now, the reason she asked that is because my mom had told the social worker, as she had told everybody throughout her life, that she was an only child. So to hear this suddenly sort of exploded one part of her biography, which until I was in my 40s, I never questioned. I knew her name was Beth. I knew she was an only child, and I was told that by her to always tell the truth. Well, her name wasn't Beth. She wasn't an only child, and obviously she didn't always tell the truth. But the more important thing was is that we did not ask her about this in 1995 because she was suffering from a depression, the psychiatrist concluded, and he wanted to treat her with medication that had as a slight risk a respiratory arrest factor. So with emphysema, that's not an easy thing, and so he wanted to monitor her in a psychiatric ward in a hospital for just a couple of weeks. Well, her reaction to that was great fear. And even though she was voluntarily there, she kept on telling me the day that she entered, Stephen, you can't leave me here. You don't understand. Well, of course, I didn't understand because I didn't know the full truth about her sister. But we didn't ask her about it at that moment because it didn't seem like the time to do that. We weren't thinking about that at all. And so my mom died 4 years later, taking her secret with her to her grave. But in that way that secrets emerged without anybody's intervention, 6 months later we received a letter from the cemetery where our grandparents are buried, a letter addressed to my mom, obviously had gone to her every year. And instead of it being, it was asking us, asking my mom, now us, if we wanted to have flowers planted on our grandparents' graves. But instead of it being two graves, it listed three. And the third grave was the secret. It was Annie, my mom's sister. And then I pursued it a little more. I won't give you all the details because it's just an involved story, but I got some hospital records by calling the state of Michigan, which is where all this was occurring. And I learned on one day when the report came clattering over the fax at the Washington Post where I was working, I sat down to read it, more out of curiosity, not writing a book, and I learned that my mom was not four, Annie was not two, my mom was 23, and Annie was 21 when she was hospitalized.
Oh, my.
So my mom's I guess at one point I kind of thought, well, if your sister goes away when you're only 4 years old, which is still very young and you hardly remember it, then maybe you are an only child. Maybe that's why she described herself that way. But now I realize that what she had told was a gigantic lie. And so I became quite curious about this, and I wanted to find out as much as I could, not only about my mom's motivations, which is really what the book is about, and about Annie's life. That's the other major stream of the book, the other major thread. But I wanted to find out about the cultural forces at work here that would cause my mom to keep such a secret. And most people, when they first hear the story, they sort of casually say, oh, it's obvious, it's shame and stigma. Well, shame and stigma is where the story begins, but it's not where the story ends, because my mom was living in a neighborhood in which everybody knew Annie. So who, from whom was she keeping the secret? Why did she create it in the first place at the age of 23? So that's the bare outlines of the story. Then genealogy became a method to find a way to recreate my mom's world. Not only did I want to find out the circle of friends that she had and family in 1940, which is when Annie entered the mental institution called Eloise outside of Detroit, but I wanted to be able to interview them. So I needed to track them down. Finding people, of course, is partly what genealogy is all about, but I also wanted to recreate the family structure so that I could find out who in the family knew, who didn't know, and why. So that's the way in which I entered into genealogy. You mentioned before that, whenever you enter down a path like this, you enter it warily, because you know that by uncovering these things, there are people who you might upset, and there's pain that you might uncover. I wasn't too worried about that, and I did have a long conversation with my siblings, of which I have four.
Uh-huh.
And some of them were more in favor than others of going down this road. But in the end, all of them were supportive. My older brother, who's been quoted publicly on this in newspaper interviews, has said that he doesn't really think you can ever stand in someone's shoes, but he thought of it as being my project and not his, so he gave me his full support.
Well, and that is, when people do embark on this, there are other people's feelings and considerations too. But, at the end of the day, I'm sure, and you can probably identify these, there were things going on within your mother's life and the way that she did things or reacted to things or, that may have given you reason to second guess now that you know the secret as to why she may have done some of the things she did and why she reacted to some of the things that she reacted to. Because, Steve, at the end of the day, when I first started doing genealogy 27 plus years ago, that's really what I started to see. I started to see, who my parents were and why they did the things they did and why they reacted to things that they reacted to. And, then going back another generation and then another generation, and you take in all these socioeconomic situations as you are, as you did in your book going back into the 1940s, there's a picture that gets painted. And,
I didn't really want to write a book of judgment about my mom, because I feel that that's unfair in a kind of very basic way, because we can't really know what somebody else was thinking. What I could do once she had died was I could find out what she had told other people and what her own rationale was. Some people have said to me, you must have felt angry at your mom in some way because she lied to you. Or even some people have asked me, based upon their own experience, I was on a radio show where the host invited people to call up and share their own stories, and one guy called up to tell a story about how his uncle was airbrushed out of family photographs after it was revealed, and this would have been the 1970s, that he was gay. And that was that generation's, and some people would still say this generation's, I suppose, generation's taboo. Well, he was mad at his parents because he felt that this uncle, who he now knows, is a wonderful guy, and he would like to have known him longer. Well, I don't feel that way about my aunt. My aunt died in 1972. She lived 31 years in the mental institution. She was born with a host of problems, including a deformed leg that was amputated when she was 17, I now know, as well as slight mental retardation. She was able to read. She was able to perceive that the world was one in which if you didn't have a job, then you wouldn't be independent. That's what she told the hospital social workers in a report that I obtained. So she wanted to have an independent life, and I think she knew, she told the social worker at one point, she knew she would never have, quote, a normal life, end quote. But if I had met her in 1972 before she died, or in 1960s when I was a teenager, it wouldn't have been a lot of fun. I mean, I would have had to go to a mental hospital to confront a woman by that point who had been institutionalized for a quarter of a century. It would have been upsetting, probably. It might have been quite important to me in some sort of formative way, but it would have been no picnic.
Right.
So I certainly am not angry at my mom for denying me that experience. As for her, you know, lying, there's no other word to use, obviously. I mean, I think her motivations, that's what I conclude in the book, I think they changed. You know, when she created them, I'm not going to reveal all the secrets because then no one will buy the book. But when she first created the secret, she had one motivation. But then as time went on, and Annie dies and my father dies, we become adults. If she were protecting her children from these terrible things when we were young, really isn't any reason for her to protect us when we're grown-ups. I think she's protecting herself. And you used the term, I think, well before, that people get trapped by their own secrets. I think the secret came to own her more than she owned it.
Exactly. You know, that's really what I see when we get involved in this kind of research is, you know, that when people, you know, people reach a certain point in their lives where they want to know. And there's a reason and a compelling reason within oneself that one wants to open up some of these doors to these secrets. And a lot of it is you know, partially a forgiveness process, I think. And also, too, is, you know, to really take hold of who we really are as individuals. And, you know, these things, you know, were part of us. And, you know, even going into, you know, some of it's a healing process. And, you know, I've had several healers and people in the, you know, spiritual community who are healers who, you know, really say that sometimes we have to clear these things out of our lineages altogether, not only for ours, but for, you know, the future generations. It's part of a clearing process. It's cutting the cord. It's saying, okay, secret, you know, you don't belong to us anymore.
Right.
We accept
Certainly,
it. It's accepted. You know, we understand it. We understand us. And, you know, let's move on. And let's, you know, move on with our lives. And I think that's really part of, you know, part and parcel of some of the concepts, I think, that are, you know, being shared. I had to laugh, you know, about the airbrushing. You know, I think that in my family, I think it was before there was airbrushing, and you could tell there was a problem because pictures were cut in half, and somebody
was cut out. That's always a great theological mystery, is why is this edge over here got a border and this edge over here does not?
Well, it's consistent.
But, you know, I was going to say that...
you found two halves of pictures, always cut
exactly. Well, if you have those, then you got the whole picture at least, but you may not have the whole quote picture. Secrets, I think it's a very tricky matter. I mean, let me tell you about one email that I received after Annie's Ghosts was published. This person wrote to say that she had been abused, as had her mother, by her grandfather, her mother's father. And this man was now dead, and she had wanted to reveal the secret for a long time. But it really wasn't exactly a secret in her telling of it, because there were other people who knew about it. It's just that the world that this man lived in didn't know about it.
Exactly.
And so she wondered whether, you know, she had made a sort of promise to her father, who was also now passed away, that she would reveal the secret at some point. And, you know, I don't feel comfortable or competent to be giving advice to somebody in that situation, so I asked her whether she had seen a counselor, and she wrote back with some humor and said, I've given a lot of money at the charity of psychiatry. I don't think I'm going to give any more. But, you know, she sounded like she had benefited from the counseling. But the point I'm trying to bring out is that what's the benign word for secrecy? I would argue it's privacy. There are things about our lives that we keep, not necessarily to ourselves, but we keep to our family or to our friends, and we don't feel any need to reveal them. I write in the book that you know, we don't need to live our lives as if it's an open book for anybody to read. I think it's fine to keep things private. I think that the confessional culture of revealing all the secrets that are going on the talk shows and telling the world about everything is not a good thing. But there are occasions, my family was certainly one of them, my mother was certainly an example of this, where keeping a secret hurts people. It causes pain. It causes guilt. It makes people trapped. And if that is happening, then one has to ask, why is the secret being kept? And if you can relieve somebody of pain by revealing a secret, then I think that it ought to be considered. Again, there might be consequences to revealing it, but I certainly would think that you got to weigh the two things and say, well, is keeping it worse than the consequences? And in most cases, I would argue that there are no consequences to revealing the secret except for the fear of being judged for having kept it in the first place.
That's correct. And also, too, and going back to that idea that's, you know, well, in today's world, I mean, you know, anybody that's got a Facebook page, you can forget about, about any secrets and privacy.
Well, yeah,
we've pretty much lost all that. I mean, if anybody wants to be, living real privacy, then don't tweet and don't Facebook, because
it's
pretty amazing what our world has come to. But on the other side of it, I think that it does, it does give us the opportunity in today's world, to be open and with ourselves, really, because, I mean, that's really where we are is, whatever we do, as long as we're truthful to ourselves, then, there really isn't any harm unless it hurts someone. And that's really what we're talking about. And, and a lot of people, I think, back in the days we're talking about, and even further back in history, we're always afraid of what, something would do to hurt someone else. And, families were a lot closer back then. I mean, when you go back into the, middle 1800s, rather, life was so different. I mean, families were living together. They were living next door to each other. I mean, you never really left the house. So it was really, kind of easier for people to, members of the family to know more about each other than it is.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of anonymity that large urban cities, for example, confer on us, that we can live next door to somebody in an apartment building or in a neighborhood for 20 years and not know a darn thing about them, if that's the way either we are as people because we don't talk to people or because that's the way they are in keeping things private. But I think with my mom, my mom, and go back to that moment I referred to before, which I describe in the first chapter of Annie's Ghost, where she's in the hospital for what is supposed to be a two-week period only, the psychiatric ward, and she stands in the middle of this day room and she says to me, "Stephen, you've got to take me home. I can't stay here. You don't understand." And of course, I don't understand. Now, I would say in that moment, what is in my mom's best interest? Is it to hold on to the secret that she's been keeping her whole life? No. Her best interest, in a very flat, non-emotional sense, is just to say to me, "I had a sister who was in a mental hospital for 31 years. Can you now understand why this place scares the living daylights out of me?"
Right.
But she can't say it. Not only can't she say it, she doesn't say it. So if she doesn't say it, then I have concluded as a writer, she is in the grip of the secret. She's not in control of the secret. The secret is control of her because her best interest is to reveal it. I don't judge her for that. I'm sort of saddened by it. I'm amazed by it. I would never want that to happen to me, but I understand it now.
Absolutely. Steve, I'm going to just out the phone number if anybody out there has a, and they don't have to reveal their secret, if they want to ask Steve any questions, or myself for that matter, about embarking on such a journey, we'd love to have your call. The toll-free number is 1-888-815-9756. Again, 888-815-9756. It's very hard for people, and especially when they've been harboring something all their lives. Working with clients who may have, you know, had an inkling of something at age 35, for example, and, you know, have harbored it until they're in their mid-60s, before they finally decide they really want to, you know, break this open. It's a very important decision that one has to make. And we certainly, I'm sure, Steve, aren't going to go advise everybody to go out and break open those secrets, because it can be a very painful and emotional journey. You mentioned just now that you were saddened, you know, with what you know now and the fact that you didn't know there. And, you know, these kinds of things can also, affect people if they are not strong enough to be able to know how to handle that. The other thing,
but in an interesting way, I actually ended up, after writing the book, which took me 2 years of research and writing. I started in early 06, and then Annie's Ghost was published in May of this year. I ended up feeling closer to my mother.
Exactly.
And the reason I felt closer was that in the last 10 years of her life, she died at the age of 82. She was still working until she was 81, and it was only a fall and the breaking of her pelvis that put her out of, put her at home, where she was still doing some part-time work for the company that she was doing bookkeeping for. But she expressed her neediness, her fear about how we might judge her without us knowing why we would even judge her. She kept expressing it in kind of little bits of asking for affirmation that we loved her. And, you know, I lived in Baltimore. My mom lived in Detroit, which is where the story takes place. And, we saw each other a lot, you know, many times a year, flying back and forth. She flew until she was about 77 years old, quite easily. But I found myself mentally pushing her away a little bit as she would ask, essentially, do you love me? But as I did this book, I got to know my mom, and this is, I think, what happens with a lot of people who do genealogy. I got to know my mom at the age of 25, and a little younger, through the friends that I found who were able to describe her as a young woman. Well, most of us don't know our parents when they're young people at all, but we don't know them at all before we're born. How could we know that? So here's an exercise, a journey that lets me get in touch with a woman at an age where, I don't know about you, but I certainly remember what I was like when I was 20 and 25 and how I felt about the world and how everything was, you know, open and like great things could happen and all that kind of stuff. So I loved getting to know my mom at that age, and because I became to understand her secret and why she kept it, I felt that I could put aside some of those negative feelings that I had as she was in the waning years of her life, and I got closer to her.
And I think when I talk about, and I mentioned, you know, forgiveness and understanding, I think that you know, part of like you say, getting to know someone is you really get to understand them better. And with a better understanding, you have a way to be more forgiving and not pass judgment on another individual. And,
right.
You know, we tend, and I think, I hope that we're getting out of it a little bit, is that, we tend to be very judgmental, in many situations. And, you know, our parents, for some reason, I mean, every time, you know, a lot of people that I talk to, I mean, we always seem to be overly judgmental about our parents, and I don't know if it's, you know, our generation or, you know, if it's multiple generations, but, I went through the same thing. My mother died in 92, and it was right when Jewish Gen was getting ready, was starting to take off, and, you know, that was where I sunk my heart into it, that was my healing process, I think, from going through that. And,
millions have benefited from your healing, I'll tell you.
Well,
Jewish Gen is an amazing thing.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It really came as part of a healing process for me. Because a lot of mothers and daughters have, issues, and we were not alone. She was an adoptee, which, we've still never really totally uncovered, her past, past her, but, she harbored a lot of abandonment and feelings that very similar to, I think, what you were sharing about your mother is, do you love me? Or, it comes from, I think, some sort of abandonment of some sort. And I think that, whether she may have felt that she abandoned her sister or, probably she had no control over that situation.
No, I don't think it would be fair at all to suggest that my mom was responsible for my aunt's involuntary commitment. My grandmother signed the petition that the state of Michigan required, the one that alleged that she was, quote, insane, end quote. But after my grandparents died in the 60s, and Annie was still alive at the hospital called Eloise, my mom did not go to visit her. The records reflect that she received no visitors for many years by the time she had died. Why didn't she visit her? Well, it was obvious. She couldn't visit her because that would be revealing the secret. I found in this process and interviewed a cousin of my mother's and therefore of me, who I'd never met before as an adult. My cousin, whose name is Anna. Unfortunately, everybody in this book is named Annie or Anna or Anne. There's all three in the book. Says that I met her when I was quite small, but I have no memory of that. The importance of that interview, though, is that she had an argument with my mother over the secret early in the 1950s. Anna happens to be a Holocaust survivor who came to the U.S. in 1949, having lost her entire family in the Holocaust in what is now Ukraine to a mass killing. She couldn't believe that my mother was keeping secret the existence of a living relative. My grandparents were not keeping Annie a secret, and my grandmother, whose name was Tilly, asked Anna, once Anna learned to drive, to take her to the mental hospital on a regular basis to visit Annie, and those visits continued for at least a decade. And Anna would sometimes take along her two children, and I also have interviewed them about what their experience and perceptions were when they went to visit Annie in the hospital. But I'd met this whole family of cousins. I never would have met them otherwise. I found them, through a combination of genealogy and just good records work. We had kept the guest book from my father's funeral in 1980, and they had attended, and I just looked them up to try to find out who they were, see if they would know anything. I didn't even know they were on my mother's side of the family. But in talking with them, the anger that Anna has harbored toward my mother for now going on 50 years for hiding the existence of her sister is still quite visceral even today. And, of course, she's had, half a century to stew over this. And so, she gives me in the book I well describe the interview I had in which she's telling me what she told my mother and she's telling me what my mother told her. Well, of course, this is Anna's point of view. It's hardly, quote, accurate. It can't be accurate. It is merely her memory of something that happened 50 years ago, and I have to take everything that she tells me not with a large grain of salt, because I don't think it's untrue, but just with the fact, I love to talk about memory because I think that memory is very interesting. I'll tell you one little anecdote. Did you read a story a couple of months ago about the opening of Abraham Lincoln's watch at the Smithsonian?
No, I did not.
Well, it's a very simple story. It won't take long. So this watch has been well noted in Lincoln circles because it was said that there was a watch that had an inscription in it, which he had left at the watch repair shop early on in his presidency in 1861. And there was supposedly an inscription inside that the watchmaker had written on the eve of day of the Civil War breaking out. He had given an interview 50 years later, just like my cousin in this story, to a newspaper, the New York Times, in which he said what the inscription was. Well, recently they realized that the watch that the Smithsonian had was the same watch that everybody had heard about for so many years, and they opened it up, and sure enough, there was an inscription on the inside.
Yes.
But rather than it saying what the guy had told the New York Times, which was, thank God we have a president who will, you know, keep us out of the war, or, I mean, who will take care of this war, and, you know, slavery is dead. That was the key line, slavery is dead. Well, when you open the watch, it said nothing about slavery, because in 1861, slavery wasn't the issue. The Union
right.
was the issue. And so why did the guy say that? Was he a liar 50 years later in 1906 when he said this? No, he wasn't a liar. He was reflecting 50 years of what the Civil War had become. And by 1906, it had become a war for slavery.
Right.
To, you know, to end slavery. So that's what I think about memory is you have to remember that when someone's telling you about something so many years later, they're also reflecting their life experiences.
That's true. And you know, when you're doing genealogy, and I'm sure you found this out, Steve, too, is, you know, when you're going back and looking at actual records, you know, when you look at different kinds of records, you're going to get information in a different kind of way. You know, for example, you know, from a birth record, you're going to get the information from the parent. Death records, you're going to get the information from the child.
Right.
And it's going to be and can be two totally different things. I'm amazed sometimes, you know, with clients that say, well, you know, how come their name was this in the birth record and the mother's name is this in the death record? And, you know, and it's different. I don't understand. And then, you know, you find them in the census, which is then another third party who's written the information down, and it's a totally different name. And, you know, that's when you do genealogy. I mean, that's part of the whole process is understanding, you know, the source of the information of the record.
Well, and it seems to me, I don't know how you felt about it in your many years of being a professional, but to me it's the fun of it, too. I mean, I think it's kind of cool when you find out that somebody's name was X and then they started calling themselves Y. Like in my mother's case, her name wasn't Beth on her birth certificate, it was Bertha. Well, is there any doubt why she might have changed her name from Bertha? It's not a name that people like anymore, so, you know, she took
right.
on a new one. She's not the first person to do that in the world, certainly. But you know, I think that, you know, I think it's so interesting when you find out, for example, that a lot of Jewish families in Eastern Europe in the 19th century didn't have last names. You know, they took on the last names for reasons that you well know, and also the whole thing about trying to avoid conscription to the Tsar's army. You know, people would have a boy and they would call him a girl. To me, that's so interesting. You know, it doesn't bother me that it's these are the fascinating things about genealogy that make it so much fun. I think to make it all serious and say, well, you know, why did they do this? Why did they do that? Well, some things are just unknowable at this point, but it doesn't make it any less interesting.
Right. And I can, and probably, you know, in doing the genealogy, when you would find something, I mean, there's a rush.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is
a rush. And I mean, it's no different. You know, I think, you know, you're an investigative reporter. And, you know, I think doing genealogy is really the same on par as being an investigator. You're just investigating dead people and alive people now, more so than it was in the past. But
well, you know, I've now been to several genealogy conventions to do book signings for Annie's Ghosts. And have sat in on some of the workshops there that, you know, you've attended for so many years, I'm sure. And I am in awe of some of the work that genealogists done. I mean, I think of myself as a partially skilled investigative reporter, but I can't hold a candle to some of the things that some professional genealogists know how to do. It's not rocket science. I'm sure I could learn it. But what I mean is that I love listening to it because I can adapt some of those techniques into the investigative reporting that I might do for a newspaper. It's all a learning process. I mean, I wrote a handbook about 25 years ago now about how to do investigative reporting. It's completely obsolete. It was before the internet. It's useless. I mean, I look at it now. I wouldn't bother to show it to you. But at the time, of course, it was a revolution in my newsroom because nobody had ever put it all down on paper before. Today I would have to completely do it, redo it. So when I began to do the book, when I began to do Annie's Ghosts, I was really starting again in some ways in some arenas, because I hadn't done reporting of that kind for a number of years, having been mostly an editor. And so one of the great rushes of doing the book was to teach myself all these new techniques. I really think that, you know, anybody can learn to be a genealogist. Some people don't have the temperament or the patience for it. I was at this convention last week, or 2 weeks ago now, and somebody who was just starting out asked me whether I would hire, if I were in his shoes, would I hire a professional? And I said, well, I can't really answer that question for you. You'll get good work if you hire the right professional. The question is whether, are you interested in the information or the journey? And I said, if you're interested in the journey, I'd do some of it yourself and get some professional help, but I wouldn't give it all over to the professional.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you know, doing work professionally, which I have been doing now for quite some time, again, you know, I see my role as a professional as someone who guides. And I don't want to do all their research, because that's giving up and taking away part of the whole journey that they've embarked on. You know, and I really agree with you. And in most of the cases that I take on are, you know, really just pieces, you know, saying, well, let's see if we can help you get past this point, and then you can move on your own. Because the high of finding something yourself and getting, you know, to a point where you can, you know, do the research yourself, I mean, that's, and with today's, you know, the changes, I mean, you know, when I started 27-odd years ago, you know, we had nothing anywhere close to, you know, the ability to get information as quickly as we can. I mean, yeah, the story that I mentioned before, I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say how quick I was able to get some information that, you know, that happened 41 years ago. And, I mean,
the Internet makes it just a stunning, you know, change from having to, I mean, even though I could have used the Internet, well, that's not actually true. I used it whenever I could, but I just still had to go to some archives in Chicago. I actually did go to Ukraine for the book.
Oh, wow.
I didn't go just to visit the ancestral homeland, although that's partly what I did. I went to this town called, it was not a shtetl, it was a town called Radzivilov, which is about 70 miles northeast of Lviv or Lvov or Lemberg, depending on how far back you want to go.
Yes.
And I used a translator, which you have to do in order to get any really good interviewing done if you don't speak Ukrainian or Russian.
Right.
But it was fascinating because I went there with a goal in mind. I wanted to understand, when my grandparents left Radzivilov in 1907 and 1914, what was it that they brought with them? What kind of attitudes toward mental illness or physical disability did they bring with them? And I think it would have been much, much harder to find that out by the Internet. That's the kind of thing you have to go and you have to talk to people, and eventually got led to a library where they had some books in Ukrainian that I couldn't possibly read, but my translator could, and he did, and it wasn't that expensive. I mean, it wasn't something, if you have no money, then you can't afford to do any of this, but you know, I targeted what I wanted. He looked for what I wanted, and you know, I told him I was concerned about cost, and that's where we went from. But it was a fascinating experience, which I would recommend to anyone to do, because it's you know, I was welcomed with open arms into the homes of people who had not told their story of saving Jews. Their families really doing it. They were too young to have been responsible, but
right.
They poured their hearts out. And when I asked this one woman who was elderly and ill and in her late 70s, I said, did you, when you were a teenager, did you know that what was going to happen in the second massacre of the Jews in that town? She said, we didn't really, we knew the first time around that they were being deported, but we didn't know they were going to be killed. And they weren't ever deported, they were killed.
Right.
But we knew, everybody knew what was going to happen the second time around, and I stood there helpless to do anything. And I believed her. You know, she was 15 years old or 14 years old or whatever it was, and you know, what does a 14-year-old do when, you know, the grind of authority and machinery and a war machine is before you. You don't go running out to try to save people.
Right.
And she had this bottled up inside her, and even if I had never written a book, I mean, this is a very, very small part of the book because it's not really about that, but, you know, cemeteries became a really important theme in my book because there's a cemetery where Annie is buried in an unmarked grave when I first saw it. Because my mother was keeping it a secret and you wouldn't mark it, I guess. I don't know. It was unmarked. There's a cemetery next to the hospital, and there are many, many cemeteries in the United States that are like this, which have which are the burial ground for the patients who had no money and were indigent or no family, and so they were buried in these potter's fields with numbered, unmarked, otherwise unmarked graves. And most of them have now become fields, and you don't even know there's anybody buried there. There are 7,441 people buried in this potter's field next to the hospital in Michigan where my aunt was. And then there's a similarly anonymous burial ground in Ukraine where there are 3,000 Jews buried.
Right.
Not buried, because nobody gave them a burial there. They were left in a mass grave. But the reason I bring it up is that it's made me think, when people have asked me, what is your book really about? And I tell them that Annie's Ghost is about secrecy, but it's not a story of secrecy. It's a story of identity. It's a story about why we care who we are, why we reinvent ourselves, the identity my mother took on, the identity that my aunt lost when she entered the hospital. You know, I did something that a lot of amateur genealogists wouldn't think to do, which is that I paid $65 to get the Census Bureau to tell me the line item, which is all they'll give you, in the 1950 census, which is not out yet publicly. But you can pay $65 for, if you can prove your family relation, then they'll just look up that one line item. So I received a report back on Annie at the mental hospital, hoping that it would identify what building she was in. I was dismayed to find that once you go into the mental hospital, the only address you have is the mental hospital. There's no identification what building you're in. Which, if you think about it, is sort of, on the one hand, it's kind of reasonable, but on the other hand, it's kind of like taking a large apartment complex, which is what those dormitories are, and saying, well, you live, in a neighborhood in Houston that's called X, but we don't identify what apartment building you're living in. Well, why not? I mean, her apartment building was building G or J, or they're all lettered. You know, why don't we know what building she was in? But anyway, it wasn't. So I made the point in the book that this was further evidence of how she became anonymous, because she didn't even have an address, not even a building number to her name, or building letter to her name. So I think the book is really a lot about identity, and I think that's what genealogy is about. You said before, again, quite well, that what we're really doing is we're looking for our family, but we're also looking for who we are. We're looking for ourselves. And that's all about identity. I mean, why do we even bother to have cemeteries if all we're going to do is put up a stone that says, here lies so-and-so? Well, because memory and identity are important to us as a culture and as a people.
And, it goes back to ancient times, too. I mean, look at how the Bible is written.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all about genealogy. I mean, it's about who we are and who we came from. And, you know, it's really very ancient, which is really quite amazing. And, you know, it's quite amazing, too, that it's taken, you know, many, many years for it to catch on. And, you know, the Internet has really been the explosive mechanism, I think, to the whole thing of genealogy. I want to pop back just a little bit to your trip to Eastern Europe, because I've been there many, many times. And I experienced some of the same things in my towns and my personal towns, and as well as in, you know, others that I visited just for visiting. But, you know, when we arrived in my ancestral town, which was Sivnis, which took me years and years to uncover because nobody in my family seemed to know where the family came from.
Mm-hmm.
And it was researching laterally, is what I call it, where I had to go after my great-grandfather's brother's daughter's birth certificate, which is where I finally got the name of the town. So just case in point, if you they'll find it on yours. Just keep on looking. I mean, it's going to be there. It's just a matter of where. But we arrived in this town, and the first thing our guy did is stopped in the oldest, probably one of the oldest people in the town, and asked for some questions in Russian. And the next thing I know, you know, here we have this babushka woman with, you know, her teeth missing, sitting in the car, and the two of them are just yapping away. And the next thing I know, we're, you know, going over the spring, and we're in about 3 to 4 feet of water, and my great aunt is screaming because, you know, she thinks we're going to drown, and we're going through the woods and through the woods and through the woods and through the woods. And it seemed like an endless journey, went on for a long, long time. And we suddenly arrived at a clearing, and there was probably one of the most magnificent statues I had ever seen of this woman holding almost in tears, holding this cloth. And this apparently was where the Jews of that particular town were brought and where they were murdered. And I suspect, you know, that not many people have seen this. It is so far out and so far removed from the town that it was just quite amazing. And the amount of effort and the beauty of it just was astonishing to me. But when we finished there, we went to the synagogue, or what was used to be the synagogue, and we were standing on the street, and as you probably are aware, they came out of the woodwork. The people at the town came out of the woodwork, and I have video of it, and there must have been 20, 30 people at the end of the day, and many who were, you know, in their 60s and 70s, you know, we're on the street corner trying to tell their story, similar, almost exactly what you mentioned to me about, you know, I mean, they would point at the houses and they said, well, so-and-so lived there and so-and-so lived there and so-and-so lived there. And, you know, they were haunted. Talk about a ghost. Mm-hmm. They were haunted by this whole thing that went on over there. And tears would be streaming down their eyes. And, I mean, it was just, you know, probably some of the most, I can't say heartwarming, because it wasn't. It was jarring, and it was emotional. And, you know, I could only empathize with the feelings that these people had as well, you know, too, of being, you know, remaining over there. And really, too, back in the, I guess this was mid to late 90s, you know, when things were just opening up, that they had, you talk about having a secret, they had carried these and harbored these secrets for quite a long time. And probably the most amazing story was, you know, we were standing there, we were getting ready to leave, and this man comes running down the street, his arms are flailing, and, you know, he's just rushing at us. And I looked at my guide, and I'm beginning to get panicked. I don't know what's happening. And at the end of the day, the story was that this man's father worked at that synagogue. And he had a chair from the synagogue, as well as the old phonograph that was used right before the synagogue was pretty much closed down, and the records. And he wanted me to have them.
Right.
And I do. And, I mean, that probably was one of the most touching parts of some of my journeys, is, you know, to know that I have something that came from the community, from where my family came from. So,
wow.
You know, and what's also interesting, too, Steve, is it's not just Eastern Europe. I mean, you know, people who are researching their families in some of these small rural communities in the United States, you know, the records in some cases don't exist similarly to the way the records don't exist in Eastern Europe. And I've been telling some of my clients in that arena, you know, you just need to make a trip. You need to do what we do in Eastern Europe. You need to find the oldest person in the town, and you need to have them take you on a tour. And these people who've been there all their lives, they're stories, and they know the stories, and they know the secrets. And, you know, we think that records are the only way to get answers or to internalize what it is that we're looking for. And sometimes just a little visit to one of these rural communities may give you just the same sense of exuberance that, you know, some of us get when we travel overseas.
Well, you know, I think you really hit on an important point because, you know, I just read this book on Spain, which had an official pact of silence, they called it. I can't remember the name and the phrase in Spanish, about the Spanish Civil War. And it was just not talked about as part of a cultural decision. In Franco and the winners of the Civil War wanted it that way, and so now they're suffering with that because there was a piece in the New Yorker about 2 or 3 months ago. I mean, it wasn't the first, but it was about the opening up of the famous Spanish writer, poet Garcia Lorca's the question about whether his grave, which is in one of these mass graves on the side of the road, should be exhumed and given a decent burial. And interestingly enough, his family didn't want it to be done. Some of them felt that, you know, you don't always need to. The grave, there is a grave. It's on the side of the road, and that's the best memorial to what really happened than to putting it into some nice, you know, cemetery somewhere. Well, they're having that argument in part because they never had that argument for 50 years, more than that now. I mean, 1935, so, you know, 70 years. And in a lot of other places where they haven't been willing to confront their demons from the past, you know, these truth and reconciliation committees that get commissions that get set up to handle the demons of the past, and you know, in a genocide or a ethnic cleansing or whatever, and you know, that's the really awful side. Well, we don't have that going on often in genealogy. We're just trying to find out, you know, much more simple things. But if there's been a pact of silence in families, you know, you sort of wonder what it is that's not being said. And you know, it's not just a matter of, as you know better than I do, of academic interest. It's, you know, there are genetic issues, not in this case, not in my family, I don't think. I mean, we have no real evidence of a long-term, either physical or mental, you know, problem. Nobody else has been born with a deformed leg. I think that was a birth trauma problem, not a genetic one. But in some families, genetics is obviously a very important question. And so if you have diabetes, for example, and you can't, you know, you have children now, and you're fearing that you don't even know that they might have diabetes. You'd like to know whether or not it comes in the cycles that it comes in families. And the only way to know that is to get some records. And I wrote a blog item about the battle between what I called privacy and history, because we've conferred, the Congress, through HIPAA, we've conferred rights upon the dead of privacy that go far beyond previous laws. I mean, we're not just protecting the privacy rights of the living, but there's no limitation. I mean, you know better than I do that census records are open 72 years after they're created, but medical records are never open. Why is that? I mean, if somebody's been dead 72 years, you don't we think we can look at their medical records? Well, if it's mental health we're worried about, aren't we just perpetuating the taboo that to have a mental illness is a problem, you know, is something that you should be ashamed of? Why shouldn't we open those records? So I think there's some questions about this, but I talked to a privacy expert who used to write legislation on Capitol Hill, and he made the very compelling point that we should have limitations on how long this privacy lasts.
We are definitely getting some long-needed rain here in the outskirts of Houston, Texas. And in so doing, we are having some thunder boomers, which pretty much cut me off the air. So we are on landlines, and we're back with Steve. And I know we were getting towards the end of our hour, but didn't want to leave everybody hanging. So, you know, in summary, I almost forgot where we were because I can't remember where we got cut off.
Hit,
but I'm going to tell you, it's pretty black outside.
Oh, good. I'm sorry. Well, maybe we should get off the phone sooner rather than later. I don't want to tempt the gods here.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, if I get fried, I. In any event, you know, I'm not. I don't remember where exactly what we were.
Well, we were talking about sort of finding out things from the past in silence. I don't know. I think I was off the air by the point. But I'll just tell you one interesting thing. You know, we have conferred, we the Congress, through our congressional representatives, we've conferred rights on the dead, privacy rights that extend far beyond other things that we've already decided. You know, census records are open 72 years after they are collected, so the next one will be opened in 2012 for 1940. But there is no limitation on how long privacy for the dead's medical records last. And, you know, because of genetics, et cetera, as we make advances, we're going to want to know more and more about some of the illnesses or conditions that people had in the past. I don't see why, and I talked to a man who has written some of this privacy legislation, so he's a privacy advocate. He doesn't see why there shouldn't be a similar limitation on medical records, that he thinks that 50 years after someone's died, you ought to open up those records so that we can see what they were all about, and that would help out in the genetic area. So I think there are some really interesting ongoing issues in the genealogy arena.
Oh, and there are, and even too, it used to be that anybody could order birth and death records, and today, yeah, there are some areas where you have to provide your driver's license and have to be within immediate families to be able to even get the records, even if they're over 75 years old.
I don't understand that. I really do. I mean, I understand that it, you know, makes it easier on bureaucracies, but I don't understand what the value of it is. I mean, I'm a pretty reasonable person, and I can see the two sides of many issues, but denying somebody a birth record, a death record, or a divorce record for somebody who is not been around for 50 years doesn't seem like a good policy to me.
No, it's not. And it really, makes it a lot more difficult on people because, as I mentioned, even in genealogy, sometimes you have to work lateral lines. Well, you know, my great-great-grandfather's daughter is in no relation to me, and I would not have been able to get that death record today, our birth record today under the current laws as I did 20 some odd years ago.
That's interesting.
Unless I actually went to the archive, which is,
I wrote a piece for Ancestry magazine, which comes out this week.
Okay.
And one of the things I wrote about in the piece is the problem of the married name.
Yes.
That is how much harder it becomes when somebody gets married because they're maiden name often disappears, and then you have to figure out what that is. And I was at the Library of Congress once, and this researcher who was I knew slightly from my visits there, you know, looking to talk to somebody, you know, just turned to me out of frustration and said, "If I were czar of the world, no woman would ever be allowed to change her name because she couldn't find this person she was looking for."
Right.
So I have this experience in my book in which I can't find somebody, and I've tracked them down. They seem to have died in 1991, and then I realized that even though I'm experienced at this kind of thing, I never thought to challenge the fact that her name was not spelled the way that it was spelled on the record.
Right.
So I learned a month and a half later that she, her name was spelled with, you know, one letter difference. I went about finding her again, did find her, and then found that she had died in between the month and a half period that I had thought I had already confirmed that her death, so I never got a chance to interview her. I might have gotten a chance had I found her a month and a half earlier. So, you know, I didn't do anything wrong. I was following the leads that I had, but it's just a good reminder for genealogists that if something is off, and I knew that something was off in this case because she was, the year I thought she was born was about a year and a half beyond the flex range that you get from the census, and I thought, well, I guess that's still within the range, but it wasn't. I mean, I knew at the time that it seemed wrong, and it was in fact wrong. So,
Those who aren't into genealogy yet, and really are interested in maybe pursuing, even if it's one little tidbit of information, is that one day could be too late.
Right.
And information does disappear. And some of the stories do disappear. Some of the stories remain, but a lot of the pieces of the stories will disappear.
Yeah, and most genealogy books, you know, they'll tell you the first thing you should do is begin with the relatives who are living, and I think that that's a good thing to do, even if their memories are faulty, because usually what they tell you is got some resemblance of what actually happened.
Yes.
Not always, but, you know, often.
And sometimes, too, there's always been a story that I've heard early on is that sometimes it's better to make a statement that might be incorrect because there's the older generations, and as we all get a little bit older, we're quick to correct, but we may not remember. You know, so it's a very interesting technique
yep.
that I've used, and it's worked really well. Steve, I think we probably have done our hour.
Okay.
Sorry
well,
for the.
No problem. Let's remind the.
Here.
Let me remind the readers, the name of the book is Annie's Ghosts, A
yes.
Journey into a Family Secret, and it's available online. It's available at bookstores. Libraries have lots of copies, and if you're a borrower rather than a buyer, that's another good way to read it.
And you have a website, I take it?
I do. It's steveluxenberg.com, very simple, my name, .com. Lots of information there, including 30 different documents and images of 30 different documents and photographs so that you can see a little bit of how I went about my genealogy.
That's wonderful.
So thanks very much, Susan. I really appreciate the time, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
I enjoyed it, too. And thanks again. Next week, everybody, we are going to have a repeat visit from Althea Gray, who is a world-renowned healer. She and I have been working on a few things, and we're going to be actually doing some readings and maybe some lineage clearing and maybe even some breaking down of some brick walls and helping people get through some of the issues that they may be finding both in their research and as well in to their spiritual side. This is Susan King. It's been a great hour with Steve Luxenberg. We'll see you next week on Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect. My website is www.susaneking.com. Everybody have a great week, and we'll see you next Tuesday.